Hi, I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 2nd of September. This hour of the program, this will grab your attention. It's a review of this book from The Economist. And the book is The Price of Altruism, George Price and the Search for the Origins of Kindness. When George Price died in January of 1975, his funeral in London was attended by five homeless men, disheveled and smelly and cold, and then alongside them were Bill Hamilton and John Maynard Smith, both distinguished British evolutionary biologists. They had come to mourn an American scientist who helped to unravel the riddle of why people should ever be kind to one another, who had chosen to give away his clothes, his possessions, and his home, and who, when his generosity was exhausted, slashed his own throat with a pair of scissors at the age of 52. Ever since Charles Darwin had published his theory of evolution in 1859, scientists have pondered whether it can explain the existence of altruism, behavior that decreases an individual's fitness, but which increases the average fitness of the group to which he or she belongs. Such benevolence is not unique to humans, but exists also in complex insect societies. Bees, for example, live in colonies headed by a queen and populated by sterile workers. One reading of Darwin's theory says that because the workers do not breed, evolution should result in their elimination, and yet this is not what happens in nature. We're getting him by phone right now, in case you're wondering why I'm talking just a wee bit longer than I usually do. Or maybe I talk this long all the time, so I shouldn't. All right, we're okay. Orrin Harmon is joining us. He is the author of this book, and Orrin has a doctorate from Oxford University, is chair of the graduate program in science, technology, and society at Bar-Ilan University, and a professor of the history of science. He is the author of The Man Who Invented the Chromosome, a documentary filmmaker and a frequent contributor to The New Republic. He lives in Tel Aviv and also in New York. And our phone number for you to join this, what should be very interesting conversation, is 800-486-8655. He teaches evolutionary theory, our guest, the history and philosophy of science and writing, and he's now working on a new book, which is a sequel to one of his previous books, Rebels, Mavericks, and Heretics in Biology. The sequel will be about outsiders in biology. And I guess you could definitely say that the gentleman he writes about, in addition to other people who are included in this book, George Price, definitely an outsider in science and a man well worth learning about. Talk at WPR is our email address. And Orrin Harmon, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Where are you today? Are you in Tel Aviv?
I'm in Tel Aviv, yeah.
Oh, you are in Tel Aviv. So was this hard to find, this guy, George Price? Is he so obscure or was he so prominent that people just wondered what happened to him? I guess I'm asking, how did you find him?
Well, actually, George Price was not well known at all, even within biology. A lot of my colleagues, a lot of evolutionary biologists, may have been aware of the Price equation, but knew very little about the man himself. There had been a few very short sort of kind of mentioned pieces here and there of a story of a man by the name of George Price, an American who came to London in the late 60s, wrote an equation and then sort of flipped, and for reasons that had to do with the equation, killed himself. And that this equation was an important advance in our understanding of altruism. But beyond that, there was really very little. So the way I found him is that I knew I'd studied the Price equation as a biologist. And then I read one of these snippets about George the man. And it sort of really stuck in my mind because it seemed like this was almost like a character from a film or something. It was an unbelievable story.
Right.
And so I started looking into it a little bit more and found out that there had been a very short article in a now defunct journal, Lingua Franca, in 2000, written by a man by the name of Jim Schwartz. And so I took a sort of deep breath, and I called Jim Schwartz, and I said, my name is Orrin Harmon, I'm very much interested in George Price, hoping that there might be papers to work from. And there was a silence on the other end of the line, and Jim said, "You know, I've become very close to George."
Oh my!
And this was a man that whom I knew had killed himself, you know, more than 30 years earlier. So obviously, he was, you know, was a very special person, exacting these kinds of influences from the grave. But then Jim was incredibly friendly, and after many conversations, gave me the numbers of George's two living daughters, Anna Marie and Kathleen, both of whom live on the west coast of the United States. And at that point, sort of very long transatlantic conversations began and developed until we became friendly enough and close enough for them to kindly invite me to their homes to look at the papers, because all of George's papers had actually been found in the squat where he killed himself and sent back following his suicide to the family in the United States. So they existed in the two dens of the two daughters. And I traveled across to America to meet the daughters and work from the papers. And luckily, I mean, incredibly, they turned out to be a real treasure trove of information about George Price that allowed me to sort of tell his story.
Oh, my, it's quite a story. I'm glad I asked that question. What about this search for human kindness? You include a lot of other people in the book in addition to George Price, those who we would think would be the opposite when we think of human kindness, and those who were traveling maybe a similar road of trying to find a better way for human beings to exist with each other, and we're looking at the world of nature.
Right. So the main theme of the book, the main question that the book looks at is where does kindness come from? And in particular, where do acts of sacrifice come from? Why are we friendly? Why are we good to one another? And this is a question, it's an age-old question that humanity has been trying to answer, you know, from the beginning of time. And there have been different solutions to the problem. Religious traditions speak of God creating humanity in his own image. And that's where kindness and morality come from. The secular traditions talk about the use of reason and sort of philosophy to reach the good and the just. And then for the first time in the 19th century, scientists began looking at this problem, the problem of the origins of morality. And in particular, Charles Darwin, when he was writing his book, The Origin of Species, immediately perceived that here was a paradox, because if evolution is a process of survival of the fittest, then how do you explain the persistence of behaviors which reduce fitness? Altruism, by definition, biological altruism, by definition, reduces fitness. So why wasn't it kicked out by the ruthless boot of natural selection? And Darwin said, if I can't explain this riddle, then my theory is worth nothing.
Hmm.
This is the main problem that the book addresses, and it turns out that there's a fascinating history of 150 years of attempts to try to crack this riddle. And probably the least known participant in this journey had been, until now, George Price, but perhaps he may very well be the most important sort of interlocutor in this debate.
Hmm. And tell me why it is that altruism reduces fitness?
Well, that's the definition of biological altruism. Any organism, and it can be a plant or an animal or an amoeba, that acts in such a way so as to confer a fitness benefit on another organism while incurring some kind of fitness cost, is an altruist by definition.
Oh, okay.
So you notice that definition doesn't include anything about intent. An amoeba can be an altruist, and an amoeba obviously doesn't have a mind and no intentions. Biological altruism is something apart from what we call psychological altruism, which is the kind of altruism that we think about and talk about when we think about altruism amongst humans. That kind of altruism is based solely on intent. So, for instance, if I do something altruistic towards you, say I help an old lady across the street, but the old lady knows that I've done it only because I have an eye on her inheritance, then she
right.
will rightly not view me as an altruist, because it's not the result of the behavior which is important, namely getting her across the street safely, but rather the intention behind the behavior.
Mm-hmm.
So So there's a difference between biological altruism and psychological altruism. They're two different things. On the other hand, and this is where it becomes really interesting, the human brain, which allows for intent and motivation and feeling and so forth, is an organ like any other organ which has undergone sort of the call of natural selection. So there must be some kind of connection between biological altruism and psychological altruism. And this was a problem that moralists and geneticists and economists and all kinds of different kinds of scientists and thinkers have been trying to figure out. And in fact, we're continuing to try to figure it out until this very day.
Hmm. And how did Darwin reconcile this? What were his final thoughts about biological altruism?
Well, Darwin actually was the father of a theory which would later be called group selection. What Darwin said when he looked at the social insects like ants, and in particular sort of the barbed sting of the honeybee, which, as we all know, sacrifices itself in order to protect the hive. When he looked at these kind of behaviors, he said the only way to explain them is that they're good for the community. He said good for the community. So you would look at a stinging bee almost like you looked at a cell within a body. It was part of a larger whole, and it did its job so that the larger whole, the larger body, could function. So that idea later became known as group selection, and has been and continues to be a very hotly debated theory. The reason behind that is the following. It's actually a logical reason. Think of a group competing with another group. If let's call them group A and group B. If group A is full of altruists, all of whom are helping each other in order to compete against group number B, then obviously group A will be more successful.
Yes.
Group A will win out over group B. But now let's look at group A just on its own. What happens if into all of the sort of group of altruists of group A suddenly meanders an egoist? Now, that egoist won't be paying the tax that all the other altruists within the group are paying. And so he will have sort of less costs, as it were. And if he passes down to his progeny the characteristic of egoism, then over time, group A will be overrun by egoists.
Mm.
So you see, altruism is a kind of problem, a very interesting kind of problem, where there's an actual conflict between the interest of the individual on the one hand and the interest of the group on the other.
Mm. And tell me exactly, let's go back to George for a minute, minutes here. What kind of altruism was George most interested in? What sparked his interest in, well, the story of his life is just incredible, but what was he looking at, biological altruism or psychological or what?
Well, I mean, okay, so maybe we should say a word about George just to introduce him, because
sure.
As you say, he really is an incredible figure. I mean, a very talented novelist couldn't have written a figure like George Price. George was born in New York in 1922, and really was a kind of real-life cross between a Forrest Gump character and a Rain Man character. meaning that he found himself, like Forrest Gump, sort of in the middle of very important scientific events and technological events in the 20th century, always solving some problem and then disappearing like a phantom. So he went to do a doctorate at the University of Chicago and sort of found himself, without him really knowing it to begin with, working on the Manhattan Project and solved a problem in having to do with uranium enrichment at that stage in the 40s. Then he moved to a completely different field, started working at Bell Labs with people like Shockley and Bardeen in sort of the beginning of the telecommunications revolution of the mid-century, working on transistor research. He then left that completely and moved to Minnesota to work as a cancer researcher at the University of Minnesota Medical Center, which was sort of the leading medical center for oncology research. And over there also had an incredibly important discovery having to do with tumor detection, using porphyrins to detect tumors. He then left that completely and invented all by himself something which would later be called computer-aided design, which is basically being able to manipulate in 3D objects on a computer. So something very, very important. He didn't take out a patent, but IBM did and then made billions from it. So this was a man who really moved from thing to thing in each particular place, did something very brilliant, and then disappeared. And then in the mid-60s, something dramatic happened to him. He found out that he had thyroid cancer, and he underwent an operation, which was successful from the point of view of eradicating the cancer, but which left him sort of somewhat disabled in one of his arms and in his shoulder. And he had been a very kinetic person, and this threw him into a real depression. And he started thinking about, basically leaving this world, that life wasn't worth living. And then he had already left his family, but he now decided to leave his job at IBM, completely abandoned his two very young daughters, and against the good advice of all of his friends, to leave everything behind and to move to England in order to try his hand at one last great scientific problem, namely cracking the great mystery ever since Darwin of the evolution of altruism. And so George arrives in London in the winter of 1967 and very quickly takes an apartment and begins to read the relevant papers on the evolution of altruism in the late opening public libraries. Now, he's never been trained in biology, and so he's reading these papers and he doesn't really understand them. But he does understand them enough to know that the important person working on the problem at this point in time is a man by the name of Bill Hamilton, who would later be known as the greatest Darwinian since Darwin, but was yet to be very famous at this stage. And George writes him a letter saying, I'd like to introduce myself. My name is George Price, and basically I'm working on the problem of altruism. I've come to crack it. And this is a man who, Hamilton had no idea who George was. He came out of the blue. He had no institutional affiliation. He was not known. He was this man who was living in an apartment in London.
Right.
And Hamilton was very friendly, sent in a reprint, and then was off to the jungles of Brazil to study social wasps, because he was still working on the problem of altruism. Social insects had been a mainstay in the research on altruism. 6 months later, Hamilton comes back to London and finds on his desk what would later be known as the Price Equation. His jaw drops.
Oh, my goodness.
Because he immediately recognizes that here is a very, very, very insightful penetration of this incredibly complex and difficult problem. And incredibly, it's come from this complete stranger, George Price. Now, in the meantime, what happened to George when Hamilton was still in the jungles of Brazil was that he wrote the equation. And it's a very beautiful and simple equation. And he walked off the street into the biostatistics department at University College London and showed it to a professor there and said, is this new? And the professor was also dumbfounded. And within a matter of an hour, George had keys to his own office and an honorary professorship at what was then probably the greatest genetics department in the world. So unbelievably unusual.
Yes.
Now, George went home and started thinking about what had just happened, because it seemed to him rather unusual and really incredible that out of all the people, who've been trying to crack this great problem, and since Darwin, all the great brains had tried their might against the problem of altruism, that out of all these people, he should have come up with this very, very incredible equation. It made no sense. And so earlier I said that he was a cross between a Forrest Gump and a Rain Man. Here's where the Rain Man part comes in. Numbers meant a lot to him. He was probably somewhere closer on the autism spectrum to autism than to normal social behavior. And he was very good with numbers. And so he began thinking about all kinds of other coincidences that had happened to him in his lifetime. Really, really strange ones. Like he'd had four girlfriends whose name was Anne. Or the last four digits of his phone number in London with 2399, which to him signified a moment before midnight or something like that, even though it should have been 2359. But to his mind, it meant a moment before midnight. And he tabulated, he basically multiplied all of these coincidences and came up with an astronomical number, 1 divided by 10 to the 30th, which meant that it really made absolutely no sense that all these things should have come, should have happened to him. And being the rationalist that he was, he did the only thing that he felt was possible, namely, he ran out of his home in Little Titchfield Street and into the church at All Souls at Langham and became an evangelical.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness.
Having come to the conclusion that God had obviously chosen him to tell some great truth to humanity.
Woo.
And this was the truth of where had kindness and altruism come from.
Let's welcome phone calls for you. We're talking this hour, as you can tell, it's an incredible story. It's The Price of Altruism. Orrin Harmon is our guest, and the book is about George Price and the search for the origins of human kindness. You may, as you hear this, think, oh, it's a really good thing that he ran into George Price, or his story would not be known as much as it is. We welcome your phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email address, if you would like to join us via email, is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, and we start our calls with Ron from Blooming Grove. Hi, Ron. Hi, Ron.
Thanks. Please explain the apparent antagonism between altruism and objectivism. I've met many diverse people, but about 18 years ago, I met one student who claimed that altruism didn't exist, or that it was a myth, or perhaps he thought that it could not possibly exist because he'd never experienced it. I'm not real certain. I don't recall what his major was in college, but he was involved with two campus groups. One was ballroom dancing, the other students of objectivism. And from what I understood, the second group was relevant to this discussion, that they were disciples of Ayn Rand or Ayn Rand, some philosopher a few decades back. Anyway, the thing that got me was that sort of as a act of faith or dogma or something, he sort of religiously refused to ever put an aluminum can, soda can, into a recycle bin. He always insisted that it go into the garbage, despite the community's efforts to recycle things. And it seemed to somehow be related to objectivism and the Rand philosophy that if he puts something usable where somebody else might use it, or it might be good for the community, not necessarily good for any individual, but good for the state as a whole, that somehow diminishes him or somehow would be altruism, and he can't possibly do anything that's altruistic. I'm confused because it's been 18 years, and I really didn't know the fellow very well, but I was confused at the time.
It's everybody certainly stayed with you. Orrin Harmon, would you like to respond?
Yes. Well, thank you. I'm not sure I heard everything because the line isn't that great. But yes, I mean, the big question about altruism always is, and in my opinion, always has been, and in my opinion, always will be, is there ever and can there ever be true, genuine altruism apart from altruism, which is basically a kind of disguised self-interest. So cynics will have it that even the greatest altruists in the world, Mother Teresa, for instance, do what they do because they get something out of it, whether consciously or not. It could even be at sort of a very sort of bodily, physical, visceral level that you get some kind of high, you know, at the physiological level, and that's why you do it. And so, so many scientists have tried to plumb this very, very difficult problem. Namely, is altruism always self-interested, or does true selflessness actually exist? Now, Ayn Rand took the position that true selflessness can never exist. There is no such thing as true, genuine benevolence, and that we should organize our polities and our societies on this assumption. And that if we continue to believe that that people really do things acts of kindness towards others because they simply want to and they're not getting anything out of it, then we will make mistakes in governing both our lives as individuals and as societies. Now, that's a very grim take on things. The reason why George Price is very interesting in this respect is because what happened to George after his conversion was that he began to think precisely about this question philosophically. And his own interpretation of his equation was that altruism is always self-interest in disguise, namely that the natural process, evolution, the best the natural process can do is to bring about a kind of second-hand, second-rate kind of kindness, not the true benevolent kind that we all hope for, but rather something which is always self-interested. And this was a terrible realization for him, for George. And so he decided to fight it. In a way, he decided to try to beat his own mathematical equation by showing that, yes, indeed, the spirit could aspire to true, genuine kindness. And that's what led George to the streets of London, where he started a kind of radical program of altruism, of radical selflessness. He started by approaching homeless people in the streets and introducing himself, saying, "Hello, my name is George. How can I help you? Can I buy you a sandwich? Can I give you a pound?" And then it graduated to him actually inviting homeless people into his home, representing them against the law with the prison system and in the courts, giving away all his money, giving away all his food, until he himself had nothing, absolutely nothing, because he wanted to show that radical selflessness was possible, that you could really give away everything without wanting to get anything back in return. But, of course, it wasn't viable. It led, in the end, to him having to leave his own apartment. He lost everything, and he became one of the vagabonds that he had set out to help. So his life really is a kind of dramatization of your question. Can there ever be true selflessness? And what I try to look at in the book is, can science ever answer this question? Do we have scientific tools that can tell us that, yes, true selflessness without an inkling of self-interest does exist? And in my opinion, looking at 150 years of science and the kind of questions that science can answer and the kind of questions that science cannot really touch, I think that science can never provide an answer to this question. And so if we want to really sort of plumb it and deal with it, we have to look to other places, not to the scientific method, in order to understand really the mystery of true benevolence and sacrifice.
Thank you, Ron, for the call. Which leads me to the question, did he need sort of this divine intervention that happened to him? Did he need God in order to inspire him to try to do this radical altruism?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, it looks as if he did need it. He had been a staunch atheist before. And in fact, his mom, he grew up in the 20s and 30s in New York during the Great Depression, and his father had died when he was a young kid, and his mom was struggling to get by with him and his older brother Edison. And his mom actually believed in spiritualism. This was something that helped her in these difficult times. And the way I found this out was when I was looking at the letters in the family archive, I saw that there were letters that were signed by William Edison Price, namely George Price's father, to his mother, but that were dated after the supposed death of William Edison Price. In other words, someone was writing letters for William Edison Price from the grave, and that someone was George's mother.
Oh, like, my goodness.
She was sort of channeling her husband in letters written to herself, the text of which was, "You are a wonderful mother, you're a wonderful person, you'll be fine, don't worry, you'll get out, you know, be strong," and so forth. So George grew up in this family where the mother was channeling her dead husband from the grave, and he really developed a strong anathema to this kind of spiritualism and what he took to be, complete. He thought it was malarkey. And so he grew up, his mind was fashioned in a very rationalist mode, in contradistinction to his mother. And so any talk of God, any talk of spiritual matters, of anything that wasn't material and could be, anything that couldn't be approached from the point of view of science and the scientific method, to him was complete anathema. And then when he came up with his equation, the shift was very dramatic. It pointed him directly into the arms of an almighty God who had chosen him to tell the truth to humanity.
Goodness. Let's go to Mary from La Crosse. Hi, Mary.
Hello. I've been listening with great interest. Thank you for taking this call.
You're welcome.
Yes, what I'd like to point out, there's numerous instances in the natural world of cooperation. I'd like to know whether cooperation is the same as altruism. For example, there's two species of rhinos, one which competes for water at watering holes and is on the endangered species list, and the other one where they take turns and it's doing fine. So is that altruism? Right. I think it's a form of
okay.
it. Those genes would be passed down more often in the ones that take turns at watering holes, would it not?
Yes. Well, that's an excellent question. And in fact, even before we reached the dawn of the evolutionary age in the 19th century with Darwin, people had thought of this. And there's a poet, a European poet, by the name of Bernard de Mandeville, who wrote a couplet which said, "Every part full of vice, the whole mass a paradise," meaning that somehow, by some kind of logic, you could get cooperation in a social context even if all the agents involved were self-interested. This was later formalized in the theory called game theory, the father of which was a very interesting man who figures in my book as well, John van Neumann, the Hungarian mathematical genius, who's also one of the fathers of the computer. But cooperation is not the same as altruism. Cooperation is a kind of behavior that makes sense from the point of view of the individual. Altruism, by definition, at least biological altruism, is a behavior that reduces fitness. That reduces fitness absolutely. Now, there's one concept which sort of gives you a kind of bridge between cooperation on the one hand and altruism on the other, and that is reciprocal altruism. Reciprocal altruism is basically the idea of you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. And sometimes, often in nature, animals partake in this kind of reciprocal altruism, even if there's a time lag. So, for instance, in a species of bat, the bats go out at night to try to find blood, usually in cows. And some of the vampire bats are successful in procuring blood, and others are not. And when they return to the cave, those that were not successful are actually fed mouth-to-mouth by those who were successful. Now, scientists have shown, although this is contested, but at the time this paper came out, it's a Wilkerson paper, what scientists had shown was that this was basically a kind of cooperative behavior where you were giving when you had in the expectation that you'd be given when you didn't have later on. And so that's reciprocal altruism. It's a kind of cooperation, but it's in the definition of types of altruism. So thanks a lot for that question. It's an important one.
Yes. So let's Let's explore a little bit more about how this gentleman, George Price, who was by all accounts quite a brilliant guy, left his family. He had two small daughters and his wife to go on this quest to determine what caused altruism. How can somebody who does such a dramatic thing, who leaves people and leaves people in need, be somebody that you would look at? I wonder this about people who are the opposite of who they appear to be. And he was in some ways that person. He was feeding the homeless, but he also left his family. So how did that figure into his search for altruism?
Right. Well, I mean, before George came to England to try to crack the problem of altruism, he actually was a man who found it very difficult to see other people and to take their emotions and feelings into account. He was really the opposite of an altruist. He wasn't a terribly, I mean, he was a very quirky and odd guy, but he wasn't a terribly nice one. And like you said, he abandoned his daughters who were very young. They were about 5, 6 at the time of the divorce, or even younger, 4 or 5, and then hardly saw them. He moved, his wife was in Minnesota and then later moved somewhere else, but he moved to the East Coast to New York City and then to New Jersey, and saw his little girls maybe 2 or 3 times in the span of 10 years.
Oh, my.
So he was really a terrible father.
Right.
Now, when he decided to crack the problem of altruism, what motivated him, and this I found in letters that he left to friends and then later to family, was he wanted to figure out how the unit, the family unit, had come about in evolution. So clearly there were very personal reasons for trying to understand particular scientific problems. And figuring out the mathematics of altruism was actually a tool which he developed in his grander quest to try to understand where family had come from. So it's one of these stories. It's very interesting how in the history of science and in the history of ideas in general, often it's people who are sort of in a surprising fashion, people who are not necessarily like what they discover or what they preach, who are able nonetheless to throw a very powerful light on a particular problem. George Price was different. He was different, and everyone who met him knew that immediately, almost immediately. And I find it really fascinating how someone different was able to tell us something very deep about a problem that we all care about very deeply. It's almost as if you have to be, in some cases, you have to be sort of, you know, out of the norm, or have to have a kind of external eye or external brain, which is different from the rest of the brains and eyes looking at things, to be able to see things clearly.
We welcome more phone calls. Orrin Harmon is our guest. His book is The Price of Altruism, George Price and the Search for the Origins of Kindness. Here's our number, 800-486-8655. And our email address is talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Next phone call is Mike in Milwaukee. Hi, Mike.
You suppose that there's a connection between these polarities you're talking about, between individuality or a strict definition of natural selection versus altruism, and our political theater as it exists, where you have people that want individuality, they want less government, they're more conservative candidates versus people that are more community-minded, they call them socialists, that we should have health care and things like that. So it presents the kind of philosophy that's polarized. Do you see that or not?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Looking at the history of attempts to crack altruism, what I found was that the scientific notions or different theories that were proposed to try to solve the solution was very much tied to philosophical and ideological commitments on the part of the scientists who were adducing them. first chapter of the book deals with the battle between two great Darwinists, two sort of late 19th century characters who interpreted Darwin in very, very different, almost opposite ways. One was Thomas Henry Huxley, who became known as Darwin's bulldog, and the other was the anarchist Prince Peter Kropotkin, a Russian anarchist, who came to understand the notions of natural selection and evolution in a very different manner. So in the case of Kropotkin, he went out to the Siberia to try to look at animals in Siberia. And wherever he looked, very, very differently to what Darwin had seen in the tropics and Huxley as well, wherever he looked, he found a lot of cooperation and altruism between animals. He saw horses making protective rings. He saw different kinds of ruminants helping each other across rivers. He saw kittens coming together to stay warm in the cold. And to him, the natural state was a state of cooperation rather than of battle and competition. And so when he came to, and this is basically what drove him to anarchism, because what he came to believe philosophically was that if we only return to our natural state, we will be returning to a state of goodness and kindness and cooperation rather than to a state of competition and warfare. Nature wasn't bloody in tooth and claw, as Tennyson had written. Rather, it was cooperative. So any kind of political association was actually moving us farther away from our natural state. And this is what led him to the philosophy, the political philosophy of anarchism. Mm. On the other hand, Huxley, his interlocutor in this debate, saw things completely differently. Where he looked in the tropics, it was all about competition. And so the natural state was a bloody state. And luckily, human beings were the only species of all creation that could fight against their natures. In other words, human beings, by creating societies with proper functioning governments and so forth, could fight the impulse to compete until the death. And so these two men, both of whom considered themselves great evolutionists, looking at nature, saw opposite pictures of reality. And they led them to opposite political philosophies. So these are the two characters off the bat. And moving forward into the 20th century, again, almost all the scientists who dealt with altruism were drawing into their science, very much so, their own ideological and political commitments.
Hmm. Thanks very much for the call. Here's an email that's come in for those of us who are not mathematical geniuses here. And if it's, I hope the answer isn't too elaborate or too involved, or we can understand what you say. How does a mathematical equation about altruism exist? That's a good question.
It's a great question.
Yeah.
It's a great question. Well, first of all, I have to explain that the theory of evolution itself, even though it's quite easy to explain the notion of natural selection and adaptation and so forth, is very much based on mathematics. It's a mathematical theory. Now, what George's equation was able to do was to show you under what precise formal conditions a particular trait like altruism, where there was a conflict between the level of the individual and the level of the group, could evolve. It's a mathematical description of the evolution of a trait as a function of the fitness that that trait provides to the altruist. And so, to put it in words rather than in math symbols, what the price equation does is two very important things. One, it shows that that altruism is not dependent on genetic relations. In other words, altruism does not equal nepotism. The Bill Hamilton that I mentioned earlier in the show, he had written a mathematical equation which basically argued that the closer related genetically two organisms are, the likelier it is that we will find altruistic behavior between them. But that was a very grim sort of notion, because what it meant was that kindness was really just reserved for family.
Mm.
What George's equation showed was that that's not true, that you don't have to be related in order, from the point of view of evolution, for altruism to make sense. That's one thing that he showed. The other thing that he showed, and this is probably the most important thing, was all scientists who had approached this problem figured out that the key to the solution was to understand at what level natural selection was working. Was it working? Was it trying to maximize the interest of the individual, the group, the lineage, maybe the gene, you know, the notion of the selfish gene? And each of the scientists posited one level at which selection was working. Dawkins famously in the 70s posited the level of the gene. Before him, there were scientists who posited the level of the group, as Darwin had done early in the 19th century. But what George's equation was able to show was that natural selection, like some giant eye, was actually looking at all levels all the time simultaneously. And so there wasn't one right solution to the problem of the level of selection, at which selection was working. George's equation can show you how selection working at different levels, say at the level of the individual and the level of the group, how that works to bring about the behavior such as altruism.
Huh. Do you think that there's improvement to be made? Are you ready to do a new equation?
Excuse me?
Are you ready to do a new equation? Is there something beyond his equation?
Well, I should mention that a friend of mine, Peter Godfrey Smith, and his collaborator Ben Kerr, actually published an equation last year, which is sort of it's an update of the Price equation. It makes it a little bit more symmetrical and a little bit more beautiful, and all that more sort of precise. Even though the Price equation, as you can understand from what I've explained, is a very general mathematical tautology, we're always working at refining our understanding of nature and using all the tools at our disposal. Math is one of them, but we have many other tools like fMRIs, neurogenetics, logic, observation of animal behavior, and so forth, to try to crack this great mystery of kindness and sacrifice to others.
Mm-hmm. June in Toronto is next. Hi, June.
Hi, Kathleen. I observed that among the birds, I live in the woods and we have many birds, that some of the birds, like bluebirds, if I come out into the yard, will stand watch if there is someone in the nest, their mate. But one day, I observed that cardinals also will come in pairs when they come to eat at the bird feeder. And there were two juveniles there. And eating at the feeder was a female juvenile and a male in the tree. And I came to the window, and he saw me, and he went into the bird feeder and did this remarkable thing. He put his wing around the female.
Oh.
I've never seen anything like it, but it touched me deeply.
Aww.
Is this kindness?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, Kathleen, could you repeat that?
Well, we've got about 30 seconds left, but she talked about cardinals and this act of protection where one cardinal put her wing around another in an act of protection in the nest. I know. I love it. Let's look for all of those instances as the day goes on.
There are many of them in nature. Everywhere we look in nature, we see an enormous amount of altruism, which is a wonderful thing indeed.
It sure is. Well, you're an interesting guy. This is a very, very good read and something that takes you to a whole new place. I thank you, Oren, so much for being with us.
My pleasure, Kathleen. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Joining us by phone from Tel Aviv. He lives in Tel Aviv and in New York. Oren Harman, who thinks about things that most of us think about, but not in this context, because he's found somebody who really thought about this and is interesting to learn about. The Price of Altruism is the name of the book, George Price and the Search for the Origins of Kindness. Oren is chair of the graduate program in science, technology, and society at Bar-Ilan University and a professor of science. And he's the author of The Man Who Invented the Chromosome. He's also a documentary filmmaker and a frequent contributor to The New Republic. Hate to let that one go, don't you? You just want to talk about it more and more. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing this hour, and thanks to Chrissy Pease for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. I'll be with you again on Labor Day on Monday. My little boy, who's now a young man, is going to college. I'm taking him to college this weekend, and it's thrilling, but it's also very, very hard, as I'm sure many of you may know. So until Monday.